is Friday, March 18th here in Washington, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. Coming up, we'll hear from VOA's Seoul Bureau Chief about how South Koreans are reacting to more missile launches by their neighbor to the north. A representative of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum shares his thoughts about the Obama administration declaring the Islamic State to be a genocidal militant group. And an animal rights group responds to U.S. theme park SeaWorld's decision to stop a controversial breeding program for killer whales.
Well, today is a step in the right direction. To do the absolute right thing by the animals now, SeaWorld has to open the tanks completely to ocean sanctuaries.
It's all ahead on International Edition. North Korea has test-fired two ballistic missiles, the latest in a series of rocket launches. They come a day after U.S. President Barack Obama imposed new sanctions on Pyongyang in response to its recent nuclear test and satellite launch. The latest North Korean missile launches follow a familiar pattern of defiance by Pyongyang in the face of punitive steps by the international community. I spoke to VOA's Seoul Bureau Chief Brian Padden a short time ago, and I asked him what more is known about the missiles fired on Friday.
Well, they were launched early Friday morning. They were two medium-range ballistic missiles. They're called Rodong missiles. They are kind of a Scud missile, which can reach about 1,000 kilometers, could reach up to Japan. These two fired, when they were fired, they reached about 800 kilometers into the sea, not quite the distance to Japan. And one of them, it was reported that it might have exploded mid-flight.
Which is a sign of apparent failure of that missile?
I'm not sure about that. It might be the sign of failure. It was certainly a test flight. And it's part of what Pyongyang has been doing, or at least it has been accelerated in its process of developing its ballistic missile technology and its nuclear capability in the last year. And so while it may have been somewhat of a failure, it's also a process for learning how to improve for the next time.
Well, how concerned are South Koreans about North Korea's advancement of its missile program, even though it's relatively gradual?
I think there's a lot of concern here in South Korea. What you have seen over the last couple years, you have seen two things. One, amongst the population, you have seen kind of people being accustomed to this constant reporting of provocations and crisis, and then the crisis kind of dissipates, and then they move on to the next kind of show of force. So people have become a bit numb to that. But on a greater scale, and particularly on government to government, they have become much more conservative in their approach, much less willing to give North Korea the benefit of the doubt, much less willing to negotiate over these issues. And so it's become a harder line standoff between the two sides.
Do you think there's any indication that the South Korean government will impose even more sanctions on the North because of this launch and hence kind of perpetuate this cycle?
If they could, they would. They've kind of hit the limit in what they could do. They closed perhaps the last remaining significant economic link between the two sides a few weeks ago when they closed this Kaesong project, putting out of work 53,000 North Koreans. They are banning North Korean ships from their ports. They are banning third parties from doing business with North Korea. So they're trying to do what they can to set an example, to hold a hard line in trying to put economic pressure and impose harsh sanctions on North Korea.
Well, thank you very much to our Seoul Bureau Chief Brian Padden for bringing us that update.
All right. Thank you.
Well, it's time now for a look at the social media world, and I'm joined here in the studio by Andrew Polchevsky. Hey, Andrew, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. So I understand today it's a tale of two algorithms, right? What
it
does that mean?
It is a tale of two algorithms. So two of the biggest social media networks in the world, Twitter and Instagram, have both instituted algorithms for their posts, but they've kind of done it in different ways. So Twitter had announced this about a month ago, said, we're going to change the way you see your tweets. Instead of being chronological, it's going to try to pull up the ones that we feel are most important, maybe the people that you retweet the most or like the most on their tweets. And people were kind of outraged by this and said, oh, well, the chronology is really what makes Twitter what it is.
And otherwise it becomes more like a Facebook.
Exactly. And that's something that actually Twitter has been trying to do, is maybe emulate some of the things that Facebook is doing, because Facebook has been very successful and 1.4 billion people around the world are Facebook users. So they're trying to reach at some of those numbers. So they started doing this algorithm implementation this week, and people were very unhappy about it, but they gave people an option to turn it off. So a lot of people are turning it off, saying, well, at least we have a choice.
What have you done, by the way?
I haven't actually seen it pop up yet. It's kind of a slow rollout, okay, just starting, so I haven't seen it yet, but I imagine when it does come up, I'll probably turn it off, because I think the chronology of Twitter is really what makes it what it is.
Right.
And then you have Instagram, which is actually purchased by Facebook not too long ago. They, out of the blue, announced they're doing an algorithm where they're putting the most popular posts at the top of your Instagram feed, but they didn't announce this really ahead of time and don't give people an option to turn it off. So they're taking, you know, kind of a different direction, but a lot of people on both sides for Twitter and Instagram unhappy about this, saying, I want to just see the feeds. I want to see the posts as they come up. However, some people on Instagram are saying, well, maybe this will winnow out some of the, you know, sponsored content or some of the posts that, you know, from friends I don't want to see.
I don't want to see that, exactly.
Exactly. So it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds. But it sounds like Twitter's maybe being a little more customer service-minded or customer-friendly.
And Instagram not so much.
And Instagram not so much. But we'll see. They may change that after some outrage.
Well, let's see if the outrage does come. Thank you so much, Andrew Polchevsky, our social media editor. And you can find him on Twitter at APAL, and I'm on Twitter as well at Michael_Lippin. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Diving for pearls, a dangerous profession, and one that for hundreds of years was the main industry for Gulf states. Today, it's oil, but there's a movement to preserve the heritage and to restore the pearl industry in Muharraq, once the diving center of the past, Nur al-Sayah of UNESCO.
So the idea behind the whole project is also to make pearling a sustainable economy for Bahrain once again.
The discovery of oil and Japan's entrance into the pearl market in 1930 killed the Arabian industry. Today, by protecting offshore oyster beds, Nur al-Sayah says an old tradition can be maintained.
The diving is going to be regulated there in order to sustain sustainable fishing and pearl diving activity.
The area's museums are luring tourists who now understand how important the pearl industry used to be. And by restoring old pearl houses of yesterday, a new foundation is set to bring back a once-dead pearl economy. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has determined that atrocities committed by the Islamic State group in Iraq and Syria constitute genocide. Kerry's declaration met a March 17th congressional deadline for the Obama administration to make a decision about the atrocities the Islamic State group has committed against religious and ethnic minorities. Cameron Hudson is director of the Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum here in Washington. VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir spoke with Hudson and asked him what the U.S. genocide designation of the Islamic State really means.
Well, I think it's highly symbolic. It's the first time, first of all, that the administration has declared a genocide, and these things are rare. They don't happen very often. The Bush administration is the last time in Darfur more than a decade ago that we declared a genocide, and before that it was the Clinton administration in Rwanda. And so these are historic events. Those are two events that marked those presidencies, and that, just as I believe that this one will mark this presidency. I think the question remains, though, is beyond the label, what are we going to do about it? And what is the set of policies that we are now undertaking, not only to treat ISIS as a terrorist group, which we've known they are for some time, but now that they are declared genocidal killers, what does that mean, and how does the policy approach to them change as a result of this announcement?
And so what do you expect to happen?
Well, in the Secretary's announcement this morning, he outlined really a set of justice and accountability measures that would, I think very correctly, try to document the crimes, the full extent of the crimes that ISIS has been committing, and then to hold those perpetrators to account. I think where there's some holes to be filled in is what exactly we mean by that. What is the appropriate legal venue for holding ISIS accountable for these crimes, and how do we conduct those investigations, and who's going to conduct those investigations? I think those are sort of open questions, but I think it's significant in the sense that up until today, we have treated ISIS solely as a terrorist group and have been conducting a war against them with little regard to the crimes that were being committed on the ground. And so I think this opens up a new policy approach for the administration to really try to gather evidence and pursue a potential prosecution for the crimes committed.
And that was Cameron Hudson of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum speaking to VOA's Margaret Bashir. Scientists are in a race against time in their efforts to stop the spread of the mosquito-borne Zika virus. The World Health Organization estimates that it could infect as many as 4 million people by the end of this year. One of the biggest fears is the virus's link to birth defects. VOA's Carol Pearson tells us about some of the mosquito control methods being developed to fight it.
Until there's a vaccine against the Zika virus, controlling it comes down to controlling the mosquito that carries it. Countries in Latin America are spraying insecticides to kill adult mosquitoes, but more needs to be done. Peter Armbruster has a mosquito lab at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C.
Outdoor spraying has limited effectiveness in that these mosquitoes breed in a wide variety of container types that typically aren't going to be exposed when widespread spraying occurs.
The mosquito that carries the Zika virus, the Aedes aegypti mosquito, lays its eggs in old tires, water cisterns, bottle caps, any place where there's a drop or two of water. Armbruster notes that it could be targeted at other stages of its life.
Insecticides can also be used to target the larval stages where the mosquitoes are living in their aquatic habitats.
Another method uses a bacterium to either sterilize the males or prevent the mosquitoes from carrying the virus. Some researchers are trying to achieve similar results by genetically modifying the mosquito. Oxitec is a British firm that has modified the male mosquito so its offspring die before they can reproduce. An Oxitec scientist told VOA that trials in the Cayman Islands and Brazil have reduced wild mosquito larvae by more than 80%. The company has plans to expand its work in Brazil. Armbruster says the best bet will be to launch a multi-track campaign.
The most effective approach to suppressing the populations is going to be to take an integrated strategy that combines things like these genetically modified mosquitoes as well as traditional use of insecticides and elimination of breeding habitat.
Some of this research is still in an early stage. In the meantime, millions of pregnant women are depending on these scientists to come up with something quickly and spare their babies the risk of lifelong disabilities linked to the Zika virus. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The dwarf planet Ceres is the largest body in the asteroid belt. Among the features of the dwarf planet are several bright spots on its surface. The most noticeable spots are located within its Achator crater. Some scientists think that this might indicate that Ceres is more active than any neighbors in the asteroid belt. Now, scientists using the HARPS spectrograph at the European Southern Observatory in Chile have found that these bright spots go through some surprising changes. While the spots have been known to change as Ceres rotates, the scientists have also found that they also vary and brighten during the day. The scientists say that their observations suggest that the bright spots may be made up of a volatile substance and that solar radiation may cause it to evaporate. NASA's Dawn spacecraft has been circling and studying Ceres and its mysterious bright spots since it arrived there about a year ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. U.S. animal theme park SeaWorld has announced that it will no longer breed killer whales or orcas at its U.S. locations. SeaWorld's 29 killer whales will remain in captivity, but they'll be involved in what the company calls new inspiring natural encounters for the park's visitors. Attendance at SeaWorld parks declined after the 2013 release of Blackfish. That's a documentary that portrayed cruel treatment of the orcas. Ben Williamson is a spokesman for U.S. animal rights group the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA. I asked Williamson what role PETA played in pressuring SeaWorld to stop the breeding of orcas.
Well, PETA has campaigned hard for decades, and today is obviously the payoff of all of that effort. We've been raising the issues of orcas and dolphins, beluga whales, seals, and many other animals for years who have suffered in SeaWorld's tiny tanks. And certainly while today is a step in the right direction, to do the absolute right thing by the animals now, SeaWorld has to open the tanks completely to ocean sanctuaries so that these long-suffering animals may have some semblance of life outside their prison tanks in the future.
Well, can you explain what would such ocean sanctuaries look like?
Well, they could be refitted fish tanks, for example. The coastal sea pens is what is the norm. We know for certain that captivity kills, and the orcas currently at SeaWorld deserve a chance at freedom. Like other cetaceans, orcas can be successfully transferred to sea pens that mimic their natural environment and could one day, hopefully, be released back into their home waters. It depends, of course, upon their individual needs and abilities, but certainly in a sea pen, or the orca's condition can be monitored and evaluated to determine how best to release them from the slavery that they're currently in.
Well, SeaWorld has said that it doesn't want to release orcas into the wild because it fears they would die, but if they put them in sea pens, how risky is that for the orca's survival?
Well, it's total bunk what SeaWorld is coming out with, frankly. Orcas are in the ocean now, and they are thriving. They're having babies, they're swimming with the families, and some are living into their 90s. And given that, it's possible that we'd even be able to identify the families that these animals were originally taken from years ago through vocal analysis and attempt to reintegrate them into their pods. What's certain is that their life in SeaWorld is absolute misery for these orcas. They stand a much better chance of survival in a sea pen where they can be monitored by outside scientists and hopefully one day have a shot at gaining their freedom.
So do you think what's holding back SeaWorld from putting them in sea pens? Is it business considerations? Is it cost?
Well, renowned international orca experts have suggested a relatively low-cost option for repurposing the fish farms that I was talking about. And since they're already survived to survive storms and currents, they can just be expanded for the larger animals, larger orcas. So they can be set up for somewhere in the neighborhood of $30,000 to $50,000, estimates go by. Of course, you can go up from there. They can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, but it's still a drop in the bucket compared to the several hundred million dollars that SeaWorld was planning to spend on its Blue World project, which would only marginally improve the current tanks in a manner that still can't meet the needs of these social animals.
Well, thank you very much to the Senior International Media Director for PETA, Ben Williamson, for speaking to VOA from Los Angeles.
Thank you very much.
The South by Southwest Festival, taking place in the southern U.S. city of Austin, Texas this week, began in 1987 as a local music event. Today, it's the world's largest music festival of its kind, with more than 2,000 performers. As VOA's Greg Flakus reports from Austin, bands from around the world come to the Texas capital city every March, seeking to be discovered or to expand their audience.
At South by Southwest, you can still hear some of the local sound, blending elements of country with rock and other Texas flavors.
We still enjoy our culture, and whether that's Tejano music or country music or whatever that culture is, I think we're trying to embrace all of it.
The diversity of Austin's musical scene was on display at the Austin Music Awards program, held in conjunction with South by Southwest, where new Austin resident Robert Plant, formerly of the British rock group Led Zeppelin, went on stage with such Texas legends as blues guitarist Jimmy Vaughn. But international groups playing at South by Southwest provide a different flavor. Austinites like Susan Peterson attend mainly to hear international groups like Lula Cruza.
I spent about 4 years in West Africa in my 20s, and so Latin beats and African beats really appeal to me. It's music that feels kind of like home to me, but I love seeing the traditions of other places.
Lula Cruz's lead singer, Alejandra Ortiz, is from Argentina. Her bandmates are from Colombia. Together, they explore both the nature and cultures of the Andean region.
We've done like a lot of deep listening and research in how the sound of an environment creates the music that then becomes part of a culture.
One foreign group that delighted many fans is Chirkut from Bangladesh. Singer Shumi says the band members incorporate traditional music with elements of rock.
We do what we love to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe that's the thing. And we are very happy that from Bangladesh, for the first time, any band can perform at South by Southwest.
Chirkut's eclectic approach even includes a banjo. In other songs, the guitarist draws on years of listening to Jimi Hendrix as well as other rock musicians. There are also bands from Europe, Taiwan, South Korea, Australia, and Mexico, adding to the diversity of sounds this year at South by Southwest. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Austin, Texas.
Well, I've never been to South by Southwest, but I hope I can go someday. That's it for International Edition on the Voice of America. Your director today was Sarah Williams, and the engineer was John Dryden. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. If you want to follow me on Twitter, you can find me at Michael_Lippin, and the show is at VOA_IE. We'll see you later.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Burma's Union Parliament has elected Tin Cho of the National League for Democracy as the country's first truly civilian president in more than 50 years. The presidential election is another important step forward in Burma's democratic transition, noted U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in a message of congratulations. Tin Cho is close advisor to National League for Democracy leader and former political prisoner Aung San Suu Kyi. He has worked with her to support Burma's democracy movement since 1992. We commend the people and institutions of Burma who continue to work together to ensure a peaceful transfer of power after the November 2015 elections, said Secretary Kerry. November's elections were another step forward in Burma's historic democratic transition and the culmination of a reform process that started in 2011 with the relaxation of press and internet censorship laws, the release of political prisoners, including Aung San Suu Kyi, and efforts to improve the electoral process. The U.S. supported these reforms by easing sanctions previously levied due to human rights abuses by the country's military junta. The U.S. also provided more than $18 million to assist the electoral process. The National League for Democracy swept the November elections, winning 77% of seats in the Union Parliament and giving it the power to choose the president. Reforms will, however, need to continue. The Burmese constitution reserves 25% of parliamentary seats and key cabinet posts for the military and allows them to name a vice president. State Department spokesman John Kirby calls the allowance of unelected officials a structural and systemic flaw, noting that the people of Burma should be allowed to vote for their leaders of their own choice. The United States remains committed to supporting the people of Burma in their ongoing pursuit of democracy, development, and national reconciliation, said Secretary Kerry. We continue to encourage political and civil leaders to work together in the spirit of national unity and reform.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.